Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The North Carolina Board of Elections is moving forward with plans to update voter registration information on tens of thousands of North Carolinians, and you may be among them. These voters, through no fault of their own, may not have included their driver's license or Social Security numbers on registration forms because the forms appeared to suggest that information was optional. Turns out it's not, and so now those voters are being asked to provide it. This issue first arose during the dispute between Allison Riggs and Jefferson Griffin over who won a seat on the state Supreme Court. The vote was close, and Griffin supporters wanted to throw out votes from voters whose registrations didn't include those numbers, among others. That request was ultimately rejected, but the Trump administration sued, and the resolution was to get voters to supply this information. But how do you know if you are among the 103,270 people affected? What happens if you don't take action? Why is this suddenly an issue? For answers to those and other questions, we turn to Brian Anderson, who has covered this extensively on his Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, where he covers North Carolina politics. And Chris Cooper is here. He's director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy at Western Carolina University and author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer. Welcome back. Good morning, guys.
Good to see you again.
Good to see you, too. So, Brian, as I read through and refreshed my memory yesterday on all of this, all these shenanigans going on, I think I got all that right. You can correct me if I didn't. But there are problems with voter registration, I think, first came to light in 2023. And in fact, before the 2024 election, the Republican National Committee sued to remove 225,000 voters from the rolls, a move rejected by a Trump-appointed federal district court judge. So had it not been for the Allison Riggs Jefferson Griffin kerfuffle and the many machinations of the Griffin campaign or Griffin supporters to find a way for him to take that seat on the state Supreme Court, would this ever really have come to the forefront? Would it be an issue that we were talking about this morning? Would the absence of Social Security and driver's license numbers simply have been forgotten about?
So, I mean, that's very well stated. For the state Republican Party, this was a lawsuit that originally filed before the election. So before this Jefferson Griffin protest had come to light, this was an issue on the NCGOP's radar. The problem for the NCGOP was they filed this lawsuit so close to the election that it couldn't really be considered on the merits effectively. So this was something on Republicans' minds. But there were months and months and months that Republicans, national Republicans, could have filed a lawsuit over these concerns and didn't. And so then it kind of became up to Jefferson Griffin to take up this mantle. Then when that case resolved, it went to the Trump administration to kind of take this up. And it's worth noting that this registration form issue stems from a 2002 federal law. And that law basically requires states to collect information from voters. And from 2013 on, there was this registration form that appeared to make collecting driver's license and Social Security information optional, which conflicted with federal law. And so this was under the McCrory administration, and it continued through Democratic administrations until in 2023, a conservative activist, Carol Snow, brought this issue to light. And what the NCSBE under Democrats said at the time was, thank you for bringing this to our attention. We're going to correct that form so it's not an issue going forward. But we're not going to go back in time and retroactively try and identify these people and correct it. Now, under Republican control, they're taking that backwards look in time. And that's why all these notices are going out.
But to be clear, the people who are affected by this have been voting without that required information for many election cycles. And just because they haven't put their Social Security or driver's license numbers down doesn't mean that they are illegally voting, particularly if the forms made it appear to be optional. Why did those forms make it appear to be optional?
I mean, sloppy election administration and not, I mean, this is an issue that had been unnoticed for like a decade. So this was not something that many people had really thought to be an issue. And I would just attribute it to the evolution of election forms over a decade, changing over time, and nobody catching this mistake for 10 years. But I think the key that everybody agrees on is no voter, from all accounts, there's no voter who did anything wrong. And that's important to mention. The Republican executive director, Sam Hayes, I talked to him, he said as much, but his view is, regardless of whose fault it was, we've got to now go in time and correct it to settle this Trump administration lawsuit we have. We don't want this thing dangling over our head.
So this affects about 103 plus thousand people. And I guess the question is, should we be surprised that it only affects 103,000 plus people, given the number of voters who are registered in the state? Why were they the ones that didn't have their driver's license or social security number on their forms when clearly, I guess everybody else does?
Well, a lot of people go to the DMV. And so when you go into the DMV and register to vote, that's where a lot of people register to vote. Not everybody, but a lot of people. And so when you go to the DMV and you get a driver's license or you show them another ID you have, sometimes a social security card, that's kind of organically collected. But sometimes when you don't go to the DMV or maybe a worker enters information incorrectly, that's where you have these issues. And it is worth noting, when Carol Snow identified this problem, the thought was this is going to affect 225,000 people. And so that was the grand total number. What we're talking about now is a subset of the problem. So there are two categories of people impacted. There's 103,000 people who basically have to correct this imminently or vote provisionally in future elections. Then there's another roughly 100,000 people who also have these issues. But they're going to be able to continue voting normally because their information's already in these state systems elsewhere.
Chris, this is clearly a violation of federal law, so we want to correct whatever anomalies have taken place over time in these voter registration forms. I don't want to belittle that in any way, but it seems to me there's a lot of politics involved in all of this because of the sudden attention that's been focused on these several hundred thousand voters who may not have their registration forms correctly filled out according to that federal law. Is it politics or is it just a desire to have everybody follow the law?
To quote a well-used meme, why not both, Mike? Right? I think it can be both, sort of at the same time. Clearly, look, it's politics. I mean, what's more political than who has the right to vote and who doesn't have the right to vote, and what kinds of barriers they need to get through to cast that vote? At the same time, I think, as you said, there was an expectation that this stuff would be on file. And so a key piece of this, I think Brian mentioned, is this provisional piece, right? So we need to make it clear to folks, if you are on this list and you do not do what we call curing registration, in other words, fixing your registration, you still get to cast a vote in 2025, 2026, and whenever. But that vote is cast provisionally. What's really interesting in the politics of this that are fascinating is, guess who gets to decide if provisional votes are counted and how? The County Board of Elections. The County Board of Elections, which, as Brian and many other folks reported, just flipped over from Democratic control to Republican control in the state of North Carolina. So
So
I think
why
the
should that
next.
make it, why should it make a difference
Sure.
which party controls when there are rules? Why
Sure.
should it make a difference which party controls that and makes that decision? Why wouldn't Democrats make the same decision? There's obviously a
Hopefully they
political
would.
motivation here. Would there
Right. Hopefully they would. Hopefully that what we don't know, right? I mean, the proof is in the pudding. We can look at past studies of provisional ballots and try to understand who's more likely and less likely to get their provisional votes counted. You would hope, you would expect, you would want that for Democrats and Republicans to make the same decision. But I think it's worth watching, right? It's worth paying attention to and just seeing, at the end of the day, we're going to have a count on who cast provisionally, which ones had it accepted, which ones didn't, and in which counties. And so I think the proof's going to be in the pudding.
And Mike, one thing I have to mention is, remember that 100 plus page SB 382 bill last year? Tucked into that bill, there were provisions that actually shortened the amount of time these ballots can kind of be fixed if there's any concerns with it. And one could make a case. I mean, Chris is the mathematician of the two of us, certainly. One could make the case that had the rules in place of SB 382 been in place for the 2024 election, maybe we would have a Supreme Court Justice Jefferson Griffin and not a Justice Allison Riggs if you had reduced the time that people could actually correct some issue. So that went from like 8 days to 3 days after the election. There's a new bill to increase it from 3 days to 5 days after the election. And so that is just worth noting on provisionals. It's going to be harder to have your provisional count going forward than it has been in the past.
So, Brian, in your Anderson Substack newsletter, you write, Anderson Alerts Substack newsletter, you write, the Elections Board unanimously adopted a plan to contact an estimated 194,000 people over the course of two mailers. The first mailer went out to 103,270 people and prioritizes those who most imminently need to update their voter registration information. Do we have a solid figure on how many people that might affect? Is it just 103,000 people they sent the mailers out to?
Yeah, so that's the first wave of mailers. Those are the people who, if they don't respond, if they don't update their information, they're going to have to vote provisionally.
So what makes them, because there's 200 and some thousand people affected by this, what makes this 103,000 people group more imminently at risk than the others?
The difference is that their information isn't already in databases elsewhere, basically. And so the state has information.
What does that mean? They're not in other databases.
So, Chris, you might be more into the nuances of it, but my understanding is information has been collected from people for maybe taxes, maybe other purposes, and that has not necessarily been directly, in other words, voters have shared information with other state agencies, but not directly with the State Board of Elections. And so the Jefferson Griffin protest, for example, he said there were about 60 plus thousand people who had this incomplete registration. The State Board looked into that and said, well, half of that is irrelevant because we have this information elsewhere. And the other half of it is relevant and actually protestable. And so that is, it's a messy, but that's kind of the issue.
So this is a violation of federal law. Once again, I don't want to minimize this, mm-hmm. but if I understand this correctly, Chris, this decision to pursue this act, this seeking out mm-hmm. these people and making them change their registration came from the Board of Elections in response to a lawsuit filed in May by the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. What was the motivation for the Trump administration to file a lawsuit about elections in North Carolina?
Look, elections in America are decentralized, right? The federal government has very, very little power at the end of the day over how we conduct our elections. There's benefits and problems to that system, but that's the one that we've got. And so the Trump administration essentially was saying, hey, these issues that Jefferson and Griffin raised, those things we kind of agree with, and we think they should have to be addressed. And so if you think about all the different parts of the Jefferson Griffin case, and there's a whole lot of them, part was this incomplete registration, the big number, the 60,000 roughly that Brian talked about before. There's also these folks who are military folks living overseas who did not provide a voter ID. Well, guess what? I guess Brian reported just yesterday, there's an omnibus bill about elections in the North Carolina General Assembly that would actually fix that problem going forward.
When we come back, we're going to find out who's on this list and who this really affects. Are there voting blocks that this affects more than others and what that means and how to fix it? And then we'll launch into discussion of other things that are happening in politics in our state. There's politics in our state? Who knew? We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and the British International School of Charlotte. Their curriculum aims to develop curiosity among middle schoolers and help them foster skills like critical thinking, collaboration, problem solving, and social awareness. More at bischarlotte.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the need to update your voter registration if you are among the 100 or 200,000 plus people in the state who have not adequately put down your driver's license and or your social security number. And to be clear, it's the last four digits of your social security number on these forms. And that's come to light in recent months for various reasons. We're talking about it with Brian Anderson, author, publisher, journalist, and the publisher of the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter, which covers North Carolina politics from Raleigh. Dr. Chris Cooper is also with us. He's the director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy and a political science professor at Western Carolina University. Chris, who are the people who are likely to find themselves on this list of people needing to cure their registration forms? The same people that Jefferson Griffin was targeting or trying to disqualify, or is this a different group of voters?
Yeah, you would think this would be a really easy question to answer, but I'm glad we have an hour here, Mike. This is going to take a little while. So the Jefferson Griffin folks, that's about 60,000.
Let me get some coffee. Go ahead.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great, the listeners should too as well, actually. That's 60,000 folks. They all voted in the last election, and they voted early or by mail. All right. So if you voted, if you didn't have any of this information, but you voted on election day, you were not challenging the Jefferson Griffin case because those ballots were not identifiable, essentially. You can talk about that if you want to, if you finish that cup of coffee. About 45% of the people who were on the Jefferson Griffin list are also on this new list, what we call the registration repair list, that is the 103,000 people. We should note that about 8,000 people have already done this process, right? So they've already gone through, fixed it. So we're now down in the list to roughly 95,000 people that are still left. So they are overlapping lists, but they are not the same list.
You looked at the list. You looked at the voter registration data and found that people who need to fix their ballots are more likely to be unaffiliated voters, meaning not Democrat, not Republican, and younger voters. Is that just by chance, or is there a strategy at work here?
It's sort of both and neither at the same time, right? So I think, as Brian talked about earlier very well, this law only applies to people who registered to vote after this 2002 law was put into place. I think it's January 1st, 2004, where it actually goes into place. So if you don't have this information, you're registered to vote before then, you're good. So by definition, right, you're talking about people who registered to vote in the last, 22 or 21 years in the state of North Carolina. That's going to get you a younger group of people, just because of the nature of the data you're selecting from. They're much more recent. But I think it's really worth mentioning how young they are. In the kind of general population of voters, average registrant is about 51 years old, give or take. This group, about 39 years old, give or take, right? So they are much, much, much younger. And I've been every day actually looking to see who has cured their registration. And the people who have cured it thus far tend to be the older folks. So younger people are more likely to be on the list. And for whatever set of reasons, they're not getting the message or executing on the message that they need to fix this.
The Raleigh News and Observer also did an analysis of this data and found that the 100,000 plus voters who have to provide this additional information were not only young and unaffiliated, but also non-white. Their analysis shows that though white voters make up 64% of voters, only 18.5% were on the list, while 18% of black voters were on the list, and they comprise only 19.4% of voters, while 57% of those who are racially undesignated and who make up about 9% of the state's voters are also on the list. Take us through that. What does all this mean?
So Kyle Inger with the News Observer ran this data, and we're getting very, very similar, really identical results from that. So it was great work by him, we should note. So it's connected to the age issue. So what we're finding is that younger people are not filling out the optional questions on the form. The optional questions on the registration form are ethnicity, race, gender, and political party. So if you leave that stuff blank, you get knocked into unidentified race, unidentified ethnicity, unidentified gender, and registered unaffiliated. And so when I ran the data And I think Kyle found very similar things. What you find is these young people are less likely to register and fill out all the parts of the form, and therefore they're being knocked into these unidentified categories and the unaffiliated party registration.
Do we know why?
Yeah. It appears that young people are not wanting to join in general. They're not wanting to fill out the form. And let's also remember, these are people that are identified because they didn't fill out the form right in the first place. So should we really be surprised that they left some things blank, right? We're selecting on folks who don't have complete information. So what we find when we look at the demographics is, lo and behold, they don't have complete information.
Brian?
I think while we're throwing numbers out, as a 29-year-old myself, I have to say what I think is the most important number that I have seen, and that is just the partisan breakdown. So, for example, Republicans in the state, the voting bloc, they are 30%. Within this group of people who will need to imminently fix their ballot in order to not cast a provisional, Republicans only represent 14%. So that is a 16-point difference. Like, it is a very big difference. For Democrats, it goes from 32% to 23%. So a 9-point underrepresentation. And then for unaffiliated voters, they're 37% of the state, but 63% of this protest list. So the big takeaway that I think people are kind of overlooking is the partisan breakdown. Like, the unaffiliated is higher for all the reasons Chris well said too, but Republicans are far less likely to be on this list than Democrats. And one could very easily make the educated guess that Jefferson Griffin made these protests. Why? In order to largely not discard the ballots of his voters, but those who would be more likely to support Democrats like Allison Riggs.
You just answered my question. So just slightly over 1% of these voters on this list are from Mecklenburg County. The same is true for Wake County. The two largest counties in the state seem to be pretty much immune to this for the most part, but the numbers are higher in places like Anson, Robeson, Lenore, Edgecombe, Bertie, and other smaller counties. Why would that be? I'm not sure which one of you should take that question.
I'll take a stab at it. Brian can jump on in. I think we need to remember that we have a lot of what we call street level bureaucrats that are taking these forms, right? So I think, as Brian talked about before, folks working at the DMV. I don't think we should expect that these people see their jobs the same way. So I'll give you a micro example. I went to update, get a real ID. Yes, it took a while, but I got in eventually. And when I did, there was a picture right above, or a sign right on the computer, and it said voter registration. Here are your options. And it had parties listed. Problem is, it didn't actually list all the parties in the state of North Carolina. And next to unaffiliated, it said you can choose your own primary. I say that to point out that you have all sorts of different people in different systems that are working in different ways. So we probably shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing kind of different patterns across the state. And you add to that that some of these places have a lot more, you know, kind of younger voters. What I found really interesting in digging into the data at the county level is the differences in the curing. So in Cherokee County, I don't know, somebody needs to give that election director a massive raise, because they have somehow cured 57% of the people that were on this registration recovery list already.
But percentages can be deceiving.
I mean, there's 126 people in Cherokee County. I mean,
exactly right.
I'd rather have 126 people to call than 112,000 people to call. So,
that's,
I mean,
exactly right.
Congrats,
that's
Cherokee, but I mean, I could make 126 calls in a week, maybe.
Depends on your cell phone plan. Okay, yeah. So how to fix all this? Brian, I know they're sending letters out to voters. We've talked about that. But if you don't want to wait for the letter to arrive, if you just want to see if you're on the list or have to be concerned about that, how difficult is that?
It's very easy. There's three things you can do. Number one, online. So you can go to payments.ncdot.gov.
See, it's difficult right there.
Oh, sorry, people.
Do it again.
Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go, step one, andersonalerts.substack.com. You're going to hit subscribe. You're going to pay for a subscription. You're going to read the article, so you don't even have. So it's all there for you. That's step one. Step two If you want to go online, you could do so basically through the NCDMV's registration portal. It doesn't cost you anything. You just continue as guest, click yes, and then you update your voter registration. That takes a couple of days to get itself processed to the State Board of Elections, but you don't even need to wait on a mailer. You can just do it online. That's one way. The other option is you can go in person to your county elections office. I have on my Substack a list where people can go that. You can also look at the NCSB website. Just go to your county elections office, go in person, bring your driver's license, bring your social security card, hand it to an elections official. That's how you do it in person. So you can do it online, you can do it in person. Or your third option, just wait for these mailers and respond to it. They're going to be prepaid postage, so that won't cost you anything. These election officials, it was a unanimously adopted plan. And part of the reason I think it was unanimously supported was because these people really want you to correct your information in the least intrusive way possible.
So if you go to do all those steps and you find out that you are, in fact, on the list, how long does it take to fix that problem? And how do you, if you're doing this on your computer at home, how do you prove any of this? I could put anybody's social security number in there. I could put anybody's driver's license number in there. How do you prove it?
So first, it's going to process, and the State Board of Elections on its side, it's going to make sure that they got accurate information, mm-hmm. and then they're going to remove you from the list. So there is a process in place. And if after 10 days, you have not, let's say today I put my information, then 10 days later, I'm still not off of the list, then you can contact your elections officials and ask for them to explain what, if any, issues there still are. But it should be give elections officials 10 days and you should be fine.
And if you care about voting, and you should care, because elections, as we have discovered, have consequences. If you care about this, should you leave this up to the vagaries of the postal system? In other words, you may get a letter. You may not get a letter because maybe you moved. Should you take it upon yourself? Should you take the initiative to go to that website and do it online, or go to the elections board and do it in person without getting the letter?
I mean, my biggest recommendation to folks is payments.ncdot.gov. Take care of it online. And how you can even find out whether you're on this list is there's a registration repair tool. If you just Google registration repair tool, you'll see from the State Board of Elections a list of names. You can easily search and see if you're on it. If you are, just go to payments.ncdot.gov and update your registration. I know it sounds like a process. I'm rolling my eyes just describing it, but I wouldn't wait for a mailer. I would rather be proactive. And that's what Democrats, Republicans, and nonpartisan officials alike are saying to do.
Chris.
Yeah, I would just... Everything Brian is saying is dead on. And I would just say, look, if you're in doubt, go to your county board of elections, call your county board of elections. Those folks are really, truly there to help you. And they've done a very good job. And I'll just add, you know, we've been cursing the darkness a lot. Now I'll shed a little bit of light here for just a second, which is that the amount of information that our state board of elections, when Democrats are in charge and now that Republicans are in charge, shares with the public is remarkable. In most states, the kind of analysis that I'm doing every day, the kind of things that Brian's reporting on, aren't available to the public. And so the fact that we can check is really pretty extraordinary. And I hope that is what continues with all these changes we see in our elections.
You hope. Is there a danger that it won't continue?
I think there's always a danger, right? That and this has nothing to do with partisanship at all, but there's always a danger that, look, some states charge $22,000 to get their voter registration list. State of North Carolina, I download it once a week on Saturday for free. So, yeah, states do this very different ways. North Carolina has, I would argue, the most open data in the entire country. And I hope it stays that way. And I hope we give not just blame, but credit where it's due. And that goes to both parties right now.
Brian, go ahead.
And one thing I want to say is elections are run by people. The chief elections director, his name is Sam Hayes. He's the executive director. He was previously general counsel to House Speaker Destin Hall. And I profiled him for the assembly. And I talked with him for 2 hours straight. He doesn't talk in sound bites. He doesn't talk in short sentences. He talks in like essays. And he really wanted to communicate to the public that he's aware of the perception that he has, but he's trying to reassure folks that he's trying to come at this in a nonpartisan way. But with state lawmakers and this elections omnibus bill, I'm sure we're going to get to, it's going to be a hard job for him to keep that perception going.
Sam Hayes replaced Karen Brinson Bell, who was the elections board, state board of elections director for a long time, until control was taken from the governor over the appointments and given to the state auditor. And so it switched parties.
Trump didn't file a lawsuit until Hayes took over.
You report that Sam Hayes has said, this project will not result, this is a quote, this project will not result in the removal of any eligible voter from the voter rolls. Instead, he says, it will result in more complete voter rolls and compliance with state and federal law. Can we take that to the bank?
Depends on your definition of eligible. If you say eligible voter is people who have long time had no issues to vote, but now suddenly do, I mean, that statement's going to conflict with that. If you say now we have to implement a court order and settle a lawsuit, and that changes the definition of who's an eligible voter, that's what Hayes is digging at. So he's doing some work on that eligible part, but technically what he is saying is accurate.
Legislatures in Republican-controlled states, including our own, have been actively working to find ways to bolster votes for themselves, for Republicans, through gerrymandering. And let's be clear, Democrats do this too, but they've been trying to find a way to bolster votes through gerrymandering, through redistricting, through restricting voting hours, reducing the number of polling places, reducing the number of weekend and early voting days in Georgia. They have said you can't bring water bottles to people standing in long lines waiting to vote, lines made longer because of reduced numbers of voting places and reduced numbers of voting hours. It's kind of a catch-22, I guess. And now the Trump administration is asking multiple states for detailed voter registration data. I only have 30 seconds, Chris. What's the end game here?
You know, I think the end game is in the eye of the beholder, right? The Trump administration is going to argue they're trying to clean things up. I think the Democrats are going to try to argue that the Republicans are trying to win elections by changing election laws.
But if the voting system is decentralized, sure, if it's controlled by the states and by the counties within those states, what good would voter registration data do the federal government?
Well, last time Trump asked for it, it turned out he asked the wrong people, including the Secretary of State of North Carolina, who has absolutely no power over elections.
I didn't answer the question, but I'll come back and try to get one when we come back from the break. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about elections and voters and voter registration and more with Brian Anderson from the Anderson Alert Substack newsletter and Dr. Chris Cooper, director of the Hare Institute for Public Policy and a political scientist at Western Carolina University, author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a NC North Carolina politics primer. I'm going to give you another shot, Chris, at answering that question.
Mike,
if the Trump administration wants more detailed voter registration data from certain states, given the decentralized nature of voting in this country, why?
I mean, obviously he thinks he has something to gain. I also think that he and the Republican brand in general campaign on election, what they call election integrity, right? And so I think he does sincerely view this as a way to make sure that's happening. Now, I tend to think that our elections have a lot of integrity as it is. I also think my sort of punch at the end there about what happened last time is actually pretty telling, because what Trump did last time was he says he's going to have this task force to go ahead and look into elections across the country. He says the first step is I'm going to get everybody to go to registration list, but he didn't quite know enough to know who is in charge of elections in various states. And so he just assumed, or his administration assumed, that it was secretaries of state everywhere. And of course, that's not the case in North Carolina and in many other states. So what that means to me is it was a campaign slogan that he wanted to follow through on, but maybe wasn't quite sure about how to do that.
Yeah, you brought up the go ahead.
I was just like, let's be clear. Trump does not understand the nuances of North Carolina election administration. I'm going to go out on a limb and say that based on the past history. So the question becomes, you know, what is the true impetus? Who's really right. behind this? I mean, you have Pam Bondi. She is the AG, head of DOJ, has obviously some history in elections. And the other notable piece of this is that RNC lawsuit that you were talking about, Mike, from earlier last year, who's the head of the RNC? Michael Whatley, former NCGOP head honcho, and now going to be a U.S. Senate candidate and potentially the next U.S. senator. So, I mean, there are people that, unlike the first Trump term, in the second Trump term, Trump has surrounded himself with people with more, I want to say, relevant backgrounds that can get his policies that he wants.
So we have these allegations primarily by Republicans at all levels about voter, alleging that there's problems with voter integrity or voting integrity, the integrity of our elections. And all experts that we've ever spoken to on this program and that most other credible news organizations have ever spoken to on ever would indicate that there is no problem at all. That it's infinitesimal, immeasurable, and would not change the outcome of any election in the country, including that for dog catcher. But we know that technology now gives both Democrats and Republicans the ability to laser target the voting districts, the way they draw those districts, that they never had before. And now that there are these moves to try to challenge and or disqualify voters or to add more restrictions and for the federal government to become more involved in local elections, Chris, have we ever seen anything like this before? And what's at stake here?
I mean, have we ever seen anything like this before? Not to this degree, right? I mean, clearly we've seen gerrymandering before. Going back to the 1940s in North Carolina, the Democrats would run these districts. They called them bacon strip districts that would run from the western part of the state to the eastern part of the state to make sure that the Republicans had absolutely no representation in Congress. So, yes, it's happened before. But what we're seeing right now with this sort of since 2000, which, by the way, to sort of tag on to what Brian said, Michael, another feature of Michael Whatley's background is he was part of the George W. Bush litigation team in Florida in 2000 that really kicked off this focus on election administration in the United States. We've seen this ramp up. And of course, starting in 2011, the redistricting battles increased because of technology, you noted, Mike, but also because people's voting patterns are more locked in and identifiable. And so that has now kicked off in the last 2 weeks. What I'm starting to refer to is tit for tat gerrymandering, where the Texans are saying, hey, we're going to get more Republicans. The Californians and the New Yorkers are saying, we're going to get more Democrats. It's going to be tit for tat. And the problem is the voters are going to be the ones who lose.
Yeah, Donald Trump has told Texas he's pressuring officials there to redraw their districts prior to the midterms because there is this risk of losing the House and or the Senate in midterms, which is generally what happens to the party that holds the White House in the midterm elections. And he wants to stave off those losses. And of course, California, one of the biggest states in the country with more voters than anybody else, and the state of New York have threatened if Texas does it, because they're conservative and Republican, we in the blue states will do it too. So where is this headed? This is all incredibly blatant.
It is blatant, and it is headed to a really bad place. I'm very concerned. So let's take the California example. California passed this nonpartisan redistricting commission. It was the goal. It is the gold standard in redistricting. And I think everybody agrees, and they should agree, that the Democrats could have gotten more seats if they had drawn the districts themselves. Right. In other words, it worked. Right. This independent redistricting commission actually did what it was supposed to do. And so now you've got Democrats in California, including folks who were on that commission, saying, well, yeah, what we did was fair, but if Texas is unfair, we also have to be unfair. And so it's going to be a race to the bottom, even more than we've already seen. It may even out the representation in terms of raw partisanship in Congress, but no one is talking about which voters actually get their voices heard. I think really devastating.
We keep talking about how the country is broken. Is the country broken, or do we have to do a complete overhaul of our election systems and our political systems, the way we elect candidates, the way we count votes? It just seems to me the whole thing has become corrupted, small c, not intentionally necessary, and not necessarily about money or even wrongdoing or lawbreaking. It's just that the system is so screwed up that the voters are the last people to be considered in all of this.
I mean, what's the incentive for lawmakers? I mean, we...
Democracy.
Yes, but I'm saying for lawmakers, yeah, that sounds... I'm going to be cynical, Mike. That sounds great, and that's important. But the cynical reality is lawmakers are incentivized by whether or not they'll be reelected. And who decides whether they're reelected? It's either the lawmakers themselves because of how they made the maps, or in a handful of contentious districts, it's up to the voters. And the sad, plain reality is voters are not necessarily steeped into the nuances of these issues. And lawmakers aren't incentivized to be more transparent. I'll give you an example. There's this elections omnibus bill that had said state and county elections officials can't encourage people to vote. You can't, quote, promote voter turnout. There was also just yesterday in the legislature, with minutes advance notice, a House Rules Committee meeting. And where was this meeting? It was going to be on the floor of the State House with minutes notice at seat 6. So what am I supposed to do if I'm a member of the public? Am I supposed to invade the House gallery and try and listen? I was 10 feet away from the speaker of a House Rules Committee that should be open meeting and accessible, and they announce it minutes before on the floor of the House, and the meeting is pretty much non-accessible. So what I'm trying to get at is that there's not much incentive for transparency. And until people put a spotlight on those issues, you know, it's like people won't do the right thing until they've exhausted all other options. And that is where we're at in so much of our politics.
We're eating our young. And that was the point of the question, because there's no impetus for the politicians that we elect to change, because it's working for them. It's not working for the voters, and it's not working for the country. And we have lobbyists, and we have all kinds of things that play a role in all of this, the outcome of these elections, et cetera, et cetera. And that is why people have lost confidence. At some point, Chris, either the country fails, which it may be in the process of doing now, or politicians have to get their act together. What's likely to happen?
Not, I don't think the country's going to fail, and I don't think that's where we are.
You don't think we're moving toward autocracy?
Moving towards is one thing. I don't think we are going to get there, right? So I think the system is fracturing. But I don't think it's going to be a bright line if and when we get there, right? So I think we're still going to have a country. We're still going to have elections, right? I hear folks, particularly on the left, saying, well, if we even have elections in 2 years, we're going to have elections, right? That doesn't mean that people shouldn't be paying attention to the
will they be legitimate elections? Will they be legitimate elections? That's the other question.
I think part of that is about how you define legitimacy, and there's another place I would
where your
argue
vote where your vote counts.
Your vote will count. The question is, what barriers are there to get people to vote and not to vote? So I'm going to vote in the 2025 election in the town of Silva. My vote will count. I am certain that is true.
Okay.
The same thing's going to happen in 2026 for me. But if for some folks, if we put in more barriers, they're not going to cast the vote. And so I think it's more nuanced than just we're going to be an autocracy or we're not, or we're going to have elections or we're not. I think it's more of a scale of legitimacy than it is we are or are not legitimate.
So before go ahead.
I got something for a tally chart, Mike. Your cynical nature will appreciate this one. For a point for Mike on this one, there are a group of people who are going to have their voting power diluted. And that is a serious threat. That is a plain reality. What am I talking about? There were these military we already talked about provisional ballots being winnowed, that time frame. What we are seeing is there are hundreds to potentially thousands of people who were accused of being never residents. We know from my reporting that there is a subset of those people who were wrongly accused, who have lived in North Carolina, were born in North Carolina, spent time in North Carolina, still have addresses, have taught at universities for decades, that are on that list. And so what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to go through the State Board of Elections, request data, finding out who's on this list. So I guess a point for Chris is that there are people who are trying to get at information and ensure people have access to vote who should. Mike, to your cynical point, there are officials who are implementing highly restrictive laws that could lead to people wrongfully losing their ability to vote. And what we already know is there's some voters who are only going to have federal only ballots for like the first time in North Carolina, who could have voted in state elections. You could have voted for your mayor. You could have voted for the Charlotte Transit Plan. You could have voted for your governor. But now in 2026 and beyond, you can only vote for president and Congress or Senate. And effectively, if you don't live in one swing congressional district and it's a midterm, your vote is pointless.
So before we run out of time, we have to talk about the governor's, the Senate race. All the things you just talked about have lessened voter confidence and increased voter skepticism, and also made people very unhappy with both political parties and with the process itself, and make them say, well, why vote? Why bother? And one of those criticisms came up among Democrats when Kamala Harris took over for Joe Biden as the candidate in the last election cycle without taking it to a primary situation with Democratic voters, because there was very little time between July and November to do something like that. So they anointed her, and that ticked off a lot of Democrats and a lot of Republicans as well. But she lost that election in part because of that. Now we have a Senate race in North Carolina in which Governor Roy Cooper has declared he will be the Democratic candidate, and that has caused Wiley Nichols to drop out. And we have Michael Whatley anointed as the Republican candidate, and there won't be anybody running against him. So there's literally no primary. So the voters are getting what the Republican and the Democratic Party want them to have. How is this different, Chris, from the old smoke-filled rooms that the primaries were supposed to eliminate?
I mean, I think we should tell folks that we will have primaries, right? So there are already three folks other than Whatley you've declared on the Republican side. So my guess is we will have a Republican primary for Senate. It looks like there's one person who's probably going to run against Cooper. I agree with you completely that at the end of the day, we're going to have Cooper versus Whatley. That's a fact. But there will be primaries. People should know that. It's not that different than the smoke-filled room. And look, I've many credible folks have argued that in some ways the smoke-filled room was better. That the primary process that we have in the United States can often lead to really screwy outcomes. And so I'd ask, look at the 11th Congressional District in Madison Cawthorn. Nobody thought that was going to come out. And clearly he's not the candidate that the Republican Party would have picked. Or look at Donald Trump even. The Republican Party, the smoke-filled Republican Party room would not have selected Donald Trump in 2016. They would have gone with Rubio or Bush or one of the more establishment Republicans. So I've seen a lot of folks argue that, hey, maybe the smoke-filled rooms are actually what we should go back to.
So Governor Cooper is allegedly a very popular politician in our state. He certainly got a lot of attention from the National Democrats. For a moment, he was on the ticket with rumored to be on the ticket with Kamala Harris, until allegedly he withdrew himself from that position. Michael Whatley has run both the state Republican and the National Republican Party. Cooper has never lost an election. Whatley has never won one because he's never run before as a candidate. So how is that? How are those dynamics likely to affect this race, Chris?
Yeah, they're going to affect it. Look, we're going to have an incredibly competitive race. We're going to have what is now being estimated at $500 million put into this race. Just stop and think about what we could do with $500 million to help the world, or even think, what could we do with $500 million if that were invested in state legislative races? What would actually affect a whole lot more policy? But put that aside. So the reality is, look, the Democrats haven't won a Senate election in North Carolina since 2008. So you say, well, maybe that is going to help the Republicans. But at the same time, obviously, Cooper has a lot of name recognition. If I walk into the Walmart in Silva, people know who Roy Cooper is. Nobody knows who the heck Michael Whatley is. And so Whatley starts with a blank slate, which is in some ways a positive and a negative. Cooper starts with a fair bit of positives, but at the same time, obviously, Republican Party that is already trying to tap him as radical Roy Cooper. That was a text message I had to my phone within 2 hours of his announcement last Monday.
But the complexion of the state is changing. Although unaffiliated voters are the largest group of voters, the number of Republican voters versus Democratic voters is about to switch. For the first time in state history, Republicans are about to outnumber the Democrats in terms of registered voters. Will that affect this race? I have 10 seconds.
Probably not, because it's really about voter turnout, and the Democrats haven't turned out since 2008 compared to the Republicans.
Dr. Chris Cooper from Western Carolina University, author of Anatomy of a Purple State, a North Carolina Politics Primer, and Brian Anderson from Anderson Alert Substack newsletter.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.